You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's Bookmark, our studio guest is Helen Scales. She'll be talking about her book, Eye of the Shoal. We'll also hear from Anne-Marie Young and Anthony Robinson about Young Palestinians Speak, Living Under Occupation, their book. And we'll also hear more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Helen.
Thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but later on we'll hear Anne-Marie and Anthony talking about their travels. And you've been around the world many times, haven't you, to see fish?
I have. I've been very lucky. It was sort of really part of my plan, I have to say, when I was a teenager and I learned to scuba dive and rather fell in love with the underwater world. Really hatched a plan to do whatever I could to travel, see the world, see the underwater world as much as I could. So, yes, I've been to some fantastic places, worked and studied around the world.
Yes, where's the best place you've been?
Oh, very tricky. Lots of wonderful things. The latest thing I did was in 2016, I actually went away for the best part of a whole year with my husband. He was on sabbatical and we did a round the world trip into various places. But the last spot we stopped off was a little tiny island in the middle of the Pacific called Palau. It was a cluster of little islands. And it's somewhere I've wanted to go to for a very long time. For marine scientists and divers, it's a sort of a holy grail of a really beautiful, untouched area of coral reef that's been really well looked after, full of extraordinary species that maybe you don't see in other places. So I'd always wanted to go. And it did not disappoint.
Oh, it sounds beautiful.
It's just, I mean, we were swimming with manta rays and enormous, just huge diversity of beautiful fish. And the reef really is in good condition. So it was very heartening. At the times at the moment when most of the news about the oceans is quite bad, to go to a place where you could genuinely feel like this is good.
Is there anywhere you want to go to that you've not been to? You went to Palau.
Yes,
you ticked that box.
Absolutely. And I'd love to go back. over time, my initial interest and my love has always been in coral reefs and tropical seas. But as I get older, I find myself actually getting a bit more diverse in my interests. And I'd quite like to go to Antarctica, down to the cold, frozen south. That would be rather fun.
Right, so that's next on the list.
Well, hopefully. I mean, that's quite hard to get to. It's expensive and difficult. So I'll try and find a way of doing that. But there are lots of other places too. Actually, on the list that could happen next year is the Galapagos Islands.
Sounds spectacular. Well, from the Galapagos Islands to home, how's the UK for you in terms of fish watching?
Oh, it is wonderful. It's where I started. I've dived for a good couple of years in Britain before I went overseas. And, you know, it's cold, you don't see as far, the water's a bit more murky, but there's still wonderful things to see, really wonderful things. Often it's a case of getting your head stuck into a seagrass bed or a kelp forest and looking really closely. I mean, I've seen seahorses just off the coast of Britain. There are beautiful, wonderful things to see. And, you know, I love also just being on the rocky shore, going rock pooling and peering under rocks and finding wonderful things there too. You know, it certainly doesn't have to be fully submerged to find some great things around our
coasts. Well, we're going to hear all about the great things you've found underwater throughout the show, but we'll start now with your first choice of music, which is rather appropriately Cayman Islands by Kings of Convenience. Why this one?
So my husband and I first discovered Kings of Convenience when we were coming back from honeymoon. We were in the Maldives, I know, how wonderful, and Sri Lanka, and it was on the aeroplane on the way home, and we just love the band. It's a Norwegian duo who play beautiful songs. This one just totally for me sums up the feeling of being on a tropical island and driving around on a moped, which I've done, and being there with wonderful people. And yeah, my husband plays this on his guitar too when we were traveling together, so it sums the whole thing up for me, really.
Thank you. alleyways to cool off in the shadows, then into the street. Following the water, there's a bearded man paddling in.
That was Cayman Islands by Kings of Convenience, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Helen Scales. Helen is a marine biologist, diver, surfer, broadcaster and writer. Her first book, Poseidon's Steed, was published in 2009. It examined the myth and reality of seahorses. Natural History magazine said it was elegant and engaging. Spirals in Time, a look at the life and afterlife of seashells, followed in 2016. It was shortlisted for the Royal Society of Biology Book Prize and picked as a book of the year by The Economist, Nature, The Times and The Guardian. In May this year, her latest book, Eye of the Shoal, was published. It's subtitled The Fishwatcher's Guide to Life, the Ocean and Everything. It weaves together Helen's many aquatic explorations with observations on the mesmerising and complex lives of fish. When she's not writing or fraternising with sea life, Helen teaches marine biology and science writing at Cambridge University and is a scientific advisor to the marine conservation charity Sea Changes. You're a very busy person, Helen. Well, sorry, let's get this out of the way first. I'm sorry, it's an obvious, shallow question. I'm sure you've been asked this many times in the past, but let's just put it on the table and then we can get rid of it. You know what I'm going to say. Scales and fish. Was there some sort of predetermination in your career, Charles?
I love it. No, in fact, it's my husband's name. I did take my husband's name when we got married. I was in the middle of doing my PhD and we met at the beginning. And actually, I tell the story a bit in the book about a glimpse of our time before we got married, while I was on a distant island thinking about him. But, you know, I didn't do that thing that presumably lots of people do if they're thinking of, you know, someone very seriously, is to think, oh, what would our name be like if I took your name? Didn't think of it at all. Actually, it was a cousin of mine who pointed out to me, you know, you do realise that if you got married, you'd have a perfect name. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, it has to happen, Dr. Scales. So by the time I finished my PhD, I decided I would be Dr. Scales and it was perfect.
Predetermination in terms of who you fall in love with.
Maybe.
Then. So when did you realise that fish, they were the creatures for you, that this was where your career and your life was going?
So, I mean, I'd always been a very nature-loving kid growing up. I mean, my family always took me outside and we loved being in nature. We spent most of our holidays down in Cornwall. We had a little cottage on the edge of Bodmin Moor and we roamed around the moors. But we also went to the beaches. I loved being on by the sea. So it was all kind of there for me. But then I was 15, I think 16, when I learned to scuba dive. It was the chance I had to do. It was for my Gold Duke of Edinburgh Sports Award. And I took a friend and I went to the local swimming pool and realised that they did classes there. And we thought it might be quite fun. So we went along. And then once a week during our A-levels, we would spend Thursday nights down at the swimming pool learning to scuba dive. And then finally got to swim outdoors in the wild. And it was that, actually. It was that moment, really, of seeing my first fish. And it did sort of take me by surprise, I have to say. I mean, it was in Britain. It was freezing cold. It was, I think it was March. It was about 4 degrees centigrade. Pretty much lost the sensation in my body. But I saw this one little fish in front of me and I realised it had this sensation of the aquarium wall just falling away in front of me. No longer was I looking in on their world. I was in their world. And if I wanted to, I could swim off after them and be in this sort of wonderful three-dimensional, completely different physical environment. And it was just, it really was an aha moment, actually. And I just thought, well, now I want to spend as much time as I can underwater. I want to know more about these creatures.
And why? What was it in particular about them? Because you might have had the same experience had you gone to the plains or the jungle in terms of seeing wildlife that close.
It's a good question. I guess it was something to do with the way they move, the way they're so different from us. They do things that we really can't do. I mean, I was pretending to be a fish with my tank of air on my back and flippers on my feet, but I could never be as beautiful and as sort of carefully in control, I think, of that three-dimensional world. It's hard to explain. And certainly the way they look also totally mesmerised me. The shapes, the movements they make in the water. And this wasn't even a beautiful coral reef fish with lovely colours. Once you get to a reef, then it's obvious why you fall in love with these extraordinary, diverse, colourful places. But even then, I think it was, maybe it was partly that I felt I'd been let into this secret world that is hard to see unless you jump in and look and hold your breath or have a scuba tank. Maybe that was partly it
being
as well.
In.
Being let into this little world that not everyone knows about and desperately wanting to know more about it.
And The Eye of the Shoal, which is a great book, I really, really loved it. You call it a fish watcher's guide. And let's just say by fish, what exactly do you mean? Because you're not really talking, you're not talking about jellyfish, octopus, seahorses, dolphins or whales, they're mammals, but you are talking about sharks. How are you defining fish?
I will keep seahorses in that group. They are fish. So the problem with the word fish is partly because we do have things that are definitely not within the same group of vertebrates. So these need to be animals with backbones that live in the sea. So jellyfish and starfish, we can rule them out immediately. They're invertebrates. They're a very different part of the animal kingdom. But there has been this centuries, millennia-long debate really about what a fish really is. Back to Aristotle's time, trying to figure out, okay, yeah, what are the whales? What are these slimy creatures with cold blood, the warm-blooded ones that nurture their young and produce milk and so on? So it's taken us a long time to sort this all out. But really, the fish are a large, large group of vertebrates that all live in the water, that mostly breathe through gills, that have limbs in the shape of fins, and they are all related to each other. We've got things like sharks and rays and weird creatures that are less well-known, things like sturgeon. There's a really big group of what we really do think of as fish. The teleosts are basically most of the fish, and that's everything from goldfish to flatfish to pufferfish, all those sorts of things. I guess really the problem people have with the definition of fish is, it, biologically, is that basically we are all fish because our ancestors came from the fish. You know, we did evolve from a group of fish that came out of the oceans and started living on land. And so some biologists have a problem with that and say, we can't ignore all the other vertebrates, the rest of us, the mammals, the reptiles, the amphibians that are the descendants of a group of fish. You can't kind of ignore them and sort of say, well, we don't count. So, but I think you can. You just have to acknowledge that we did. We evolved deep down in long, long ago in the fish evolutionary tree, sort of 400 million years ago, we went off our own way. The fish stayed in the oceans and in the water and continued to evolve into lots of new species that evolved much later than we did. So,
well, yes, number of species. I mean, you're talking, how many species of fish?
About 30,000, we think. 30,000. Yeah, and there's loads. And that's one point I make in the book, which is that the fish really, they're half of the vertebrates, really. So there's half, if we take the vertebrates as a whole, all of these backboned creatures, half of them are fish. The other half are all the rest of us, the mammals, the birds and everything else. So they're incredibly diverse. They're almost, can think of them almost as this great experiment in evolution. They've done so many interesting and weird things in the oceans and underwater that we haven't seen on land. So we can.
Well, yes, you describe them as one of the greatest success stories of life on Earth.
Yeah, and because the oceans are so big. I mean, we definitely live on a blue planet. There's no doubt about it. Look at Earth from space, and you clearly see that 70% of the surface of the planet is covered in water. Think about the depth of the oceans, which on average are 4 kilometres, and it's the biggest living space. And certainly among the vertebrates, the fish reign supreme in the ocean. So there are lots of invertebrates, critters that are doing pretty well, but the fish are definitely the vertebrates that are doing the best. So, yeah, I think so. And they've just taken up every niche, every little piece of the oceans. They live on the bottom. They swim through the open waters, drift across the surface, and have evolved all sorts of extraordinary ways to survive and
yes,
thrive.
The way they've adapted. Lots of chapters on that, which is really interesting. Yeah. Their colour, the toxins, the light, sound even. That was a new one to me that fish can hear.
Yeah, so I get that's a big part of what I wanted to do with the book, which was to show that a lot of these myths that have been surrounding fish for a very long time are definitely not true, but just partly because they live in this other world, other part of our world that we don't see. There have been these assumptions that fish are quiet, they don't make sounds and they can't hear. Well, actually they do, but it's taken people to go and look and listen, and also the technologies to pick up those sounds and to understand what they can hear, to find out that they are actually really sonic, and they have a sort of, that's a really important part of their ecosystem and their ecology is making sounds to each other, to other species, and being able to interact with each other that way.
And as I said, I really enjoyed the book. It's really a good read, beautifully written, but I have to say, when it arrived in the post, I did think, oh, fish, they've got a bit of bad reputation, have they, in terms of being a bit boring. I mean,
exactly.
They're not, you know, your book is so not.
Well, that's exactly why I wrote it, because I think a lot of people, that is the case, are either fish or food. And I don't really talk about that in the book too much. I sort of acknowledge that, that that we eat them, and that in some cases there's problems, well, a lot of the time there's problems of overfishing. But I put that to one side, and the whole point is I want to show that they are more than this reputation, that the reputation surrounding them would tell us. You know, they aren't these boring, cold-blooded, slimy, dull-witted, stupid animals. They have so much more going on. So really, you're my perfect audience to sort of convert you to the way of fish. Because, yeah, I do. I think they get a bit of a raw deal.
And what I really loved as well is you weave in stories from folklore and myth about fish as well. Each chapter starts with a short story from history, really, or from tradition.
Yeah, so I'm fascinated by the way that people have reflected on nature and other animals through our stories for, you know, throughout human history. We've sort of absorbed those ideas and put them into stories in so many different ways. And so when I was writing the book, I started looking around to see what sort of stories people have told about fish. You know, how have they reflected these animals in our own mythologies? And there's a lot of them that are about food and fishing, and that's fine. But I was trying to find other things, like other ways that people interact with fish. And it was really wonderful to find cultures all around the world taking these animals and making them characters that were dangerous or are great companions in sort of adventures or the source of great knowledge. And I do think it really does reflect this deep but quite complex relationship that people have with fish.
Well, thank you, Helen. We'll come back and talk to you more about fish very shortly, but we'll take a little bit of a sidestep now. Anthony Robinson and Amory Young worked together on Refugee Diaries, a series of books published in 2008 and 2009, telling the individual stories of child refugees. In their latest collaboration, Young Palestinians Speak, Living Under Occupation, they interview children and young people between 8 and 16 years of age about their experience of growing up in the occupied territories. When Anne-Marie and Anthony came to the Cambridge 105 radio studios, I asked them how the book came about.
We have for a long time been concerned with giving children in particular who are denied a voice a chance to be heard, because we believe that everyone should be heard and should be listened to.
So this is as much a kind of personal journey
for you.
It is. Yeah.
Yes, very much. Our first project doing this was, we started in 2005, I think, with the Refugee Diaries. And then Anthony went on and wrote Street Children, where he went off and interviewed street children. And then a few years ago, we heard the award-winning Palestinian author Raja Shahadeh talking about his book Palestinian Walks, Notes on a Vanishing Landscape. And this was really a turning point for us. We felt we couldn't do anything about the injustices that we knew about that were happening in the occupied territories in Palestine. But we realised then that we could give a voice to young Palestinians. And so that's what we decided to do. That was the beginning of the project.
So who are your expected readers for this book?
English speakers in the first instance, young people aged between 10 and 18. It's very accessible language it's written in, and adults would also find it appropriate and accessible, I think. As reviewers have commented, our aim was to write the balance in the reporting on Palestine.
Did you actually go over to Palestine?
Yes, we visited Palestine three times between 2013 and 2017. We spent two intensive periods visiting many different places, in fact nine in the end, throughout the occupied territories, interviewing young people, their teachers and others involved with them. And we had two video conferences with children and outreach workers in Gaza. And we also followed up with video conferences with young writers in Gaza. Our third visit was in April last year, and it was to launch the book in Jerusalem and Ramallah before publication in the US first and then in the UK. And we also took the book back to the nine places where we'd interviewed all the children and young people.
And the children and young people, how did you find them?
We found them burning to speak. I don't know what I expected before I got there, but I didn't expect them to be as open and as willing to speak as they were. But they do feel their isolation acutely, especially in Gaza. And they wanted to tell us about their lives so they could connect with others out there, as one of the kids referred to the rest of the world. They're also keen to talk about their lives in the round, which also surprised me. Not just their struggles under occupation. They want to talk about their futures, their day-to-day pleasures. They're just kids. They're ordinary kids in extraordinary circumstances, sometimes life-threatening.
And how did you physically find them? Did you go into villages and towns and ask who wanted to speak, or had you arranged this in advance?
No, we arranged it in advance. We were fortunate enough, through friends and contacts, we were put in touch with the Tama Institute for Community Education, based in Ramallah and Gaza.
To say the project wouldn't have happened without them would be a grand understatement. Palestine's a very complex place, and without them it would have been hopeless.
So given you were speaking to a wide range of people in all these different environments, were there common factors? Were there common things that they raised?
What we found was that they were all ordinary young people caught up in, I think, as Anthony said earlier, extraordinary, sometimes life-threatening circumstances. They talked about their ordinary lives. They had things to say about reading books and being on the internet. So they wanted to talk about their ordinary lives and the things they liked and didn't like. But they also did want to tell us, of course, about all the difficulties. We had a list of possible questions. And when we first met the group or the small number of children, we told them these are the kinds of things we want to know about. And then we had an informal discussion. But we did ask the questions, so that in the book there are the questions and their replies. They know their lives aren't ordinary. They know that things are difficult. We found them very willing to talk and wanting to talk, and they wanted to connect to the larger world, to talk about the weight that they feel of the occupation.
Or the fear.
The fear, yeah. They didn't want to be portrayed as victims. That was very clear.
They wanted to make people aware of their struggle and what it's like living under occupation. They're most concerned, most of them, it seemed to me, another thing I wouldn't have predicted, that they have no real freedom of movement in their own country. Someone said, well, she just dreams of going to the beach because you need permission to do so much. Permission's usually denied. They want freedom from fear. They want decent living conditions for the people that are still in camps. They want no more summary arrests. They want no more children arrested. It just goes on and on.
And living under life-threatening conditions must obviously be affecting how they're growing up and how they're maturing as young people.
Particularly in Gaza. In all the other places, there were incidences where they did feel that their lives were threatened, where, for example, the really radical, extreme settlers who want all the Palestinians out, from the age of 12, they're allowed to have guns and fire them. And so the children in particular in those areas feel that their lives are threatened. But everywhere they just have this weight of the restraints, the constraints on their lives.
It also becomes noticeable as you interview them. As they get older, they become more and more angry. You don't have to be a genius to see that once you're angry, it can become politicised and there's no fight to be had. They can't win it. So it's a bit unnerving sometimes, but it's understandable.
Could you share some of the quotes that you got from these young people about how
yes.
they see their life?
So Samia, an 11-year-old girl from Gaza, said to us, "We are suffering here in Gaza because of the occupation. We have dreams like other children, children's dreams. I would tell about what it's like living in an occupied country and how kids suffer and dream of living in safety." One of the people we interviewed was the librarian in Gaza, and she showed us, we've reproduced in the book, some of the drawings that the children did after the 2014 bombardment of Gaza. And these children are completely traumatised. They were completely traumatised. They certainly don't feel any safety. They feel like they're living in a prison. Another, Noor, a 14-year-old boy, also from Gaza, said, "It's not living, we survive. Some families are separated and might never see each other again. It's too crowded here. There's no space and not enough housing for families. Everybody gets tense, fights start. We are prisoners and have no control over our lives." This is from a girl called Samar from Hebron. "I feel afraid sometimes, threatened and scared. It's an everyday worry. Whether anything happens or not, it's there. I don't know what to expect when I come out of the house, when I cross the barrier at the end of the street. I sometimes meet settlers and they stone and curse us. Sometimes it's settler children who do it. Sometimes it's adults."
This is quite shocking. How was it for you? How did it make you feel hearing all this from children and young people?
I prided myself forever as a writer as having a sense of detachment or a gap between the things that I see and the things that I write about. But, I mean, it just got too much in Palestine. It's the powerlessness and the gut reaction we all have to bullying and our right to defend ourselves. I think it just comes down to a human reaction. It's very, very difficult.
Because we've done this sort of thing before, we've heard refugee children telling their pretty horrendous stories. We knew it was going to be difficult. We just kept going, but we would come back at the end of a long day of travelling out and interviewing children and coming back, and we were both completely exhausted. It was very tough. I mean, the nice things were that the children, the younger ones in particular, did laugh. You know, when they were telling us about their family and the positive things, that made us feel somewhat better. So it wasn't all negative, because we wanted to show their lives in the round, and that's what they did.
Have you taken the book back? Have they had a chance to read the book?
Yes. This is what we did last year. We went back to all the places we'd been to before. We weren't able to see the children mostly because this was a few years later and most of them had moved on. But we saw all of the adults, and we went back and talked to them and showed them the book. And we were so moved by their response. It was extraordinary. I mean, I get slightly tearful remembering it. And what astonished us was that they said, thank you so much for coming back, for bringing this to us. And we said, well, of course, this is yours. This is, of course, we came back. And they said that so many people go and interview them and write articles and so on, never come back, never let them know what's happening.
Which just increases their sense of isolation.
Yes, of isolation. And one of the things that was so good when we went, it was back to Janine, one of the older young people we'd met there. His ambition was to be a doctor. And we asked, how was he? And we were so delighted to find out that he'd done extremely well in all of his courses, and he was in his second year at least, or third year of medicine in Morocco. So he'd managed to get out and do that.
And how do these young people see their future?
Hope rather than expectation. They want things to settle down. They're quite happy to live with the Israelis and to share the land. Others just want out. So it's bookended by both those things. From all of them, you get this enormous respect and love of their history, their tradition, and their land, their alad, as they call it. And it's just been taken away from them. The peace process now is a smokescreen behind which more settlements are being built, more people have been shot up, more farming land's been taken away. That's what they find heartbreaking.
And Young Palestinians Speak, Living Under Occupation by Anthony Robinson and Anne-Marie Young is published by Interlink Books. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is Helen Scales, talking about her book Eye of the Shell. Quite an emotional interview there with Anne-Marie and Anthony. I mean, very different subject matter, Helen, but when you encounter fish, it seems quite emotional for you, the way you write about it. You do have quite emotional moments with them.
I guess so. I mean, yeah, it's a very different world. I'm escaping from anything in any way traumatic that as we've just been hearing about. But yeah, I guess there has to be that emotional connection, really, to a world that's drawn me in so for so many years, and I hope I continue to be visiting for the rest of my life. And it's hard to really pin down why that is. I don't know. I guess maybe there is. I mean, we talk about this connection to nature that people have in all different ways, that biodiversity, that the diversity of species and living creatures matters to us and does good things to our brains when we immerse ourselves in these worlds. So maybe it's partly that it's actually changing my mood. It's making me feel happier and more free and released. I mean, yeah, there's no greater feeling of freedom than floating through the ocean and saying goodbye to gravity, the physical side of it too, is also wonderful, but it's always best when you're looking at some cool creatures as well. So
have you ever felt in danger?
Occasionally, very, very occasionally, really not too much. Never from living creatures, only from the physical conditions. So there's been a couple of times when there's been things like a downwelling current on a dive, which is sucking you deeper down than you want to go, and you've got to sort of push against that. That really doesn't happen very much. Or a strong current pushing you offshore, those sorts of things. You just have to be aware of that and have safety precautions in place to deal with that. But no, I mean, I've dived many times with creatures that are potentially dangerous, things like sharks and jellyfish, but it's always just much more a case of great wonder than any sense of trouble.
Yeah. Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Radiohead and Weird Fishes. Why this one?
I'm a big Radiohead fan and I just love this song. It sort of takes you down into the weird world of the deep sea and things going on down there.
Thank you.
with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest, Helen Scales, talking about her book, Eye of the Shoal. Now, let's talk about the shoal then, because you've been in a shoal of fish. What is it like to be in the midst of all those? I mean, you're looking at thousands of fish sometimes.
Absolutely. You can't really count them sometimes. It is an extraordinary experience. You really get a sense that these fish are somehow coordinating their movements, their bodies, to be almost as one. You do feel like you're in the middle of like a great big super organism that's responding and watching you. I mean, thousands of pairs of eyes all around you. I mean, one moment in particular that I will always remember was diving in New Zealand as a part of this trip that I did 2 years ago with my husband. And the waters around New Zealand are not as warm as many places we went on the rest of the trip, but still just full of wonderful wildlife, really colourful, wonderful fish. And we were diving in this one site, which apparently Jacques Cousteau said was one of his favourite places to dive when he was around. It's like a sort of sunken underwater cathedral, this great big rock space that forms this ginormous chamber, and you could swim into it and just get a sense of this enormous space. And inside this cathedral was this shoal of these blue fish called blue mau maus, little blue silvery fish, kind of just a circle with a triangle on the end of it, a really stereotypical fish sort of shape. And I just sort of drifted up into the centre. I mean, imagine that you were in a cathedral and you could just sort of float off the floor and hover in the middle of this space. And then this shoal of fish just sort of swept up to me, and it didn't touch me. They wouldn't do that. But found myself in the eye of this shoal. And it was just a serene moment of the space and the animals, their movements and their response. And, you know, I had to wonder what they were making of me, this big bubbling beast amongst them. But it was fabulous.
Gosh, it sounds beautiful. And when you're in the middle of it, as you say, they're moving like one organism. How would they do? Is that a conscious or unconscious thing? How do they do that?
I mean, it's something that scientists are still trying to unpick. How do fish, as well as other shoaling, swarming organisms, so birds, you might see starlings flying in great flocks that look like a shoal of fish as well, a school of fish. I should say the two technical terms that we have slight different, so I'm cheating a bit with the title of the book, that a shoal of fish is any kind of aggregation. They can be swimming in different ways. It's the school when they're doing this wonderful swimming in the same direction in very kind of coordinated, synchronised movements. So you can sort of shoaling to schooling kind of flick between the two. But anyway, it doesn't matter too much, but there we go.
Technically,
in the school of fish. But we know that they are, it is a conscious thing. Previously, we used to think that it was just a kind of a pre-programmed kind of mindless thing. But we now know that each fish is watching very carefully the other fish around it, responding to their movements. They have very fast reflexes, which is one reason why it looks like they're all going together. But in fact, it's just a very, very quick response to, OK, that one's a bit, the one in front of me is going further, I should catch up, or it's coming too close, I should slow down. It's turning this way, I'll turn this way. And actually, the school is made up of fish doing different things. The ones at the front are the leaders. They're the bold ones that want, maybe they're more hungry as well, they want to get to the food first. And then there are followers who would generally, over time, will always hang at the back of a school as well. So they've got different personalities, these fish, that doing different things within the school. But they are, they're watching each other, they're making decisions on how to move, especially when it comes to dangerous situations like a predator coming, and they know, okay, we've got to go this way, that way to escape from being eaten.
Well, we're just about to hear from some young writers now, the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. This is a beautifully written book, Helen, and you know, obviously you're a marine biologist, you're qualified. There's no reason that therefore you should be a good writer, which you are. So have you always wanted to be a writer?
Do you know, I haven't actually. And if you went back and found me at school and told me that I was going to do this, I would have not believed you, actually. I liked English, but I was never particularly good at it at school. I didn't really write stories. This came to me much later. It was when I was doing my PhD, actually, and you have to basically write a book, a science book. And I really enjoyed the writing part and found that most people around me doing the same thing really hated that part. And I was like, actually, this is the bit I really like. Maybe I could carry on doing this.
And here you are, three books later.
There you go.
Well, as I say, let's listen now to writers right at the beginning of their career, hopefully. The annual Rock Road Library Writing Competition is open to children and young people aged between 7 and 16 years of age. The theme this year was Home as Inspiration, with entrants invited to submit poetry or short stories. We'll hear two winning entries now. First up is Hope by Radar Hack, read by James Steadman, followed by What Would It Be Like to Be Homeless by Edie Kendrew, read by Izzy Rees. Both were winners in the 7 to 11-year-old category.
It's cold and wet. I get thumping headaches from the vehicle screeching and the drunken people shouting. In my bag is my raincoat, a couple of random clothes, a bit of money, and family pictures. I was thrown out because we were very low on money. Very low. I sometimes go to the homeless shelter, but it's always so crowded. Why are you here? Who has the heart to throw out a 10-year-old boy? They say. Every day I get about 30p, which to me is normal. Once someone gave me an amazing £3. It might have been because they felt a smidge of sympathy for me. I always dream about cuddling on the sofa with my family, watching sports matches with my dad and eating homemade food. Wait, I hear two men whispering. We need to hurry up. Can you believe Mum wanted to give some of her inheritance to the homeless? Oh no, we have to burn that homeless shelter down. Yes, after the funeral on Thursday. This is bad news. Wanting to take their Mum's inheritance instead of giving it to us homeless. I wonder who this Mum is. Wait, my friend Mrs. Gandhi would know. She knows everyone in town. Mrs. Gandhi is an old woman who lives in the flats near my usual spot for sleeping. I help her carry her shopping bags and, in return, get a biscuit. Sometimes I get to stay round and tell her about my life and she gives me a big hug. She was the grandma I always wanted. I'm walking to her door, but newspaper covers the walls. When I go back to my spot, there's a letter waiting for me on my bag. Dear Thomas Hankley, I'm writing to inform you that the beloved lady who lived on Sesame Road in flat 12A, Mrs. Gandhi, has sadly passed away in her sleep. In her will, she asked for you to attend her funeral. We understand that you will need a new suit. You all right, son? A man with a lovely calm voice asks. My eyes flicker open and I notice my sack is beside me. You fainted on the street. Lucky I was around to help. My eyes focus, and there is a middle-aged man standing in front of me in police gear. His badge says, Mr. Dorney. You better get up, he says. It's Thursday. Thursday? I jolt up. It was only Tuesday yesterday. You've been asleep a very long time, Mr. Dorney says. I was worried about you, and I'm going to be taking care of you today. Now into the shower. I follow his orders. I don't remember the last time I had a shower. Cold. Oh, wait, it's getting hotter. Oh, goodness. I love the dropping sensation. I look down to see muddy water. For me, I must shampoo into my hair, and when I wash it out, bits and pieces come with it. Next, peppermint body wash. I smell incredible. I come out of the shower and brush my teeth. I brush so hard it starts to bleed. I look in the mirror. Fresh hair, cleaner teeth and smooth body. Oh, I feel a lot better. I suddenly remember about the two men who were going to take Mrs. Gandhi's inheritance. Right, go change, Mr. Dorney says. There's a black suit waiting for me with a white shirt and a black bow tie. Thank you, Mr. Dorney, I say. Please, call me Chris, he says. I nod and we are driving off to the funeral, listening to a bunch of music. We end up singing. I haven't had this feeling since I had my first hug with Mrs. Gandhi. It's an amazing feeling, and I love it so much. I don't think I want to call my mother and father mine anymore. I look out of the window and see the homeless shelter. They wave and give me a thumbs up. They know how much Mrs. Gandhi meant to me. Chris and I sit down together in the church. Chris, I say, did Mrs. Gandhi ever have any kids? Of course she did, he says. She had two sons, but they didn't turn out quite the best. Before I can ask him anything else, the man at the front starts saying prayers, and Mrs. Gandhi is in the grave. I'm still crying in the car. Chris knows he can't look after me, but he's bought me new jeans and a top. I walk back to my space. I sit back in my spot, and try to sleep. A couple of days passed, but I can't stop thinking about the shelter. I figure out a plan and I go to the homeless shelter. "Everyone here," I say. "I'm a 10-year-old boy, but believe me, this place will be burnt by two selfish men. You must evacuate." "Wait, who's that? It's not anyone I've seen before. Why are they lighting a candle? Not one, but lots." "Fire!" I scream with all my might. Everyone grabs their stuff and we all rush out. I watch from afar. People arrive to the scene, but it's too late. A tear falls to the ground and a hand gives me a tissue.
"You did well, Thomas," Chris says while holding my shoulder. I can't help but hug him. I only met him recently, but he feels like a father.
The firefighters have left. The shelter is dead, lifeless and gone. Chris is taking me to a new shelter. When I walk in, there are cakes and snacks on the table.
"Surprise!"
Everyone jumps up and I feel extraordinary. Chris had planned the entire thing for me. We start eating and people come into the shelter to join in. There is music and I'm laughing lots. "We've heard that you saved all these people." A man with a camera appears.
We hear a voice outside. "We're the two sons of Mrs. Gandhi. Jason and Alan, come out. We have evidence that you burnt down the homeless shelter."
"How did they?" I say, but Chris winks and says,
"It's a secret."
When I was around 4 years old, I used to think that people who lived on the streets chose to sleep outdoors. I thought they were having a trip in the urban jungle. It wasn't until a year or so later that I learned the sad truth. These people did not have a home. They had nowhere to relax and talk to their family after a hard day at work, and nowhere to cook a warm, comforting meal or get a good night's sleep. Think about how terrible that would feel. You spend your whole day trudging around town, searching for a good place to sleep. All of your belongings live in your frostbitten bag, and when you finally plonk your things down, it starts to rain. Biting cold droplets land on your ancient grey coat and slowly dribble down, bringing all of your hope with them. You watch hurried shoppers sprint for the sales, bashing you over with oversized bags, crammed with things you could never afford. When they see you, they hurry off, careful to avoid eye contact. They treat you like you're a monster ready to pounce. Your only friend is your dog, who you spend your little money on. His big brown eyes are pained with hunger as your money is not enough, even though you work so hard to earn it. Worry tugs relentlessly at your mind. Your life is constantly on the edge, and one wrong move could push it off. It seems like your life is only cigarette smoke, the bustle of town, chewing gum, the endless worry of finding somewhere to live. And you have made no progress. It is like living in a black hole, and you can see no way of escaping it.
And that was What Would It Be Like to Be Homeless by Edie Kendrew. That was read by Izzy Rees. And before that, we heard Hope by Radar Hack, which was read by James Steadman. Well, sadly, Helen, we're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark. But we've got a few questions still to fit in. One of the things I really enjoyed about the book was the way that you say how fish can teach us as human beings. And we were talking about the shoal earlier, the position of fish in shoal. You were saying how people are using that, humans are using that to decide where turbines go.
That's right, and wind turbines, yeah. So just the idea of how to, fish place themselves in a sort of in a shoal so that they make the most of each other, and the wake that they leave behind in the water can actually help boost the one behind. Rather than get in the way, they put themselves in just the right position to sort of swim along carefully. And if we do the same with wind turbines, you can actually make them, I think, something like, was it 10% more efficient? So, certainly a significant improvement in efficiency just by placing the blades as if they were in a shoal of school.
And we're observing and learning more about these creatures all the time.
We are, exactly. And they are revealing more and more of their secrets, and some of this we can apply to the human world. We're finding all sorts of inspiration amongst all sorts of aspects of the oceans and marine life are telling us more than we ever thought before about this extraordinary place.
So yeah. What's next for you?
So I will continue to write books. I hope I've got a couple in the pipeline already. One including my first children's book, which I'm excited about.
Oh, that is exciting.
Yeah, so it's still non-fiction. I would love to eventually write stories, although just having heard those two, I feel like I should have started a lot earlier. Those were brilliant.
Amazing, weren't they?
So I've written a book about a very special place in the oceans, which I won't tell you about quite yet. Still slightly under wraps, but it will be an illustrated non-fiction book. We're currently doing the illustrations. I won't do that, but we've got a lovely artist to work with us. About a wonderful place in the oceans that unfortunately is at great risk. So I will kind of lift the lid on what we can do about that. So that one's coming out next year. A bit sooner than that, I also have a book about octopuses coming out.
Oh, lovely. Everybody so, likes an octopus, don't they?
Exactly. So that comes out in October. It's actually a ladybird expert book, the little books that are now coming out on different topics of history and science and all sorts of things. And there's a whole bunch out there already. But mine will be the octopuses. And we're also doing the artwork for that right now. So.
And the question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
So, as always, I'm reading lots of books at the same time. I seem to never be able to do one at a time. I'm currently reading Neil Gaiman's non-fiction collection, A View from the Cheap Seats, which I'm enjoying. And I am also rereading Roger Deakins' Wildwood, because I love this time of year. May and June is my favourite, when the world around us is greening up. And I felt it was the perfect time to revisit his book about trees. So I'm really enjoying that.
Lovely. Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment to hear your final choice of music. Just a head up that our next show, which is the last in the present series of Bookmark, our studio guest will be Tamsin Gray. She'll be talking about her debut novel, She's Not There. We'll also hear from Paige Toon on her new novel, 5 Years From Now, and the final tranche of winners from the Rock Road Library writing competition. If I could also give you a heads up from about a competition run by, well, friends of the show, really, Myriad Editions publisher. We featured many of their authors on this show. This is a competition that they're running called First Drafts Competition. It's an award to launch unpublished writers and is open to women writers of African heritage or descent who have a work in progress. Fiction or narrative non-fiction such as memoir can be submitted. The winning entry will be published next year in a major new international anthology alongside the likes of Mallory Blackman and Zadie Smith. The closing date for that is the 6th of July, and you can find out more on the Myriad website, which is Myriad Edition. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Helen, which is, I think I'm pronouncing this right, Starol Fur by Sigur Rós. Why this one?
So this is a song from, it's used in one of my favourite films, The Life Aquatic by Wes Anderson. It's the final scene where a version of Jacques Cousteau, very loosely played by Bill Murray, and his team are in a submarine deep, deep under the ocean looking for the elusive jaguar shark. And they finally see it, and it just, I mean, Sigur Rós's music is so big, and it inspires you to think about huge, wonderful spaces in your mind. And I think this was the perfect tune for summing up the feeling of being deep underwater, seeing extraordinary things. So I don't know, it's sort of storytelling in sounds for me, really. I love it.
Thank you, Helen. Lovely talking to you today.